Welcome to the Daily Friend Show, offering insightful and thought-provoking news commentary and analysis from a classically liberal centrist perspective. The show is brought to you by the Institute of Race Relations. Tune in at 4:30 every Monday to Thursday for engaging discussions from our team of analysts and researchers that you won't find anywhere else.
Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. It's me, Nicholas Lorimer, your host, and I'm joined today by Ms. Sara Gahn. Sara, how are you this fine Monday morning? You're muted, Sara, so we cannot hear your words of wisdom.
God, it's because these different programs have mute in different places. I've enjoyed the rain. It's actually nice and cooling and stuff.
Oh, yes. So up in Joburg, it is, of course, raining, and it rained quite heavily a little while ago. Mm. Thankfully, not now. But that's cooled us all down. And Mr. Herman Pretorius joining us from the nation's capital, I believe. Herman, how are you?
I am fine, thank you. I just glanced out of my window. We also had a bit of rain earlier today, but mostly what I'm currently doing is holding back a sneeze.
Very good. Very good. So, as we can see, it's a bit of a Monday start today.
So I just want to say, if the sneeze, just occurs, it's somewhere in the ether. It's not quite committed to happening yet. So do excuse me if there's just this sudden blast of either silence or ungodly noise from my side.
Okay, fantastic. We'll keep that in mind. Right. So, of course, I'm sure everyone is sick to death of hearing about COVID and vaccines, and everyone has views on these things. But there are some developments that we should probably talk about before we get into the other topics today, just to keep everyone on the same page. So, of course, the government has promised a great many things, the rolling out its vaccine. We finally settled on a candidate. We're focusing for now, at least, on the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, which I believe requires only one dose, which is why one of the reasons it's become more popular. Also, it doesn't need to be stored in super cold fridges, and also it isn't as ineffective as the AstraZeneca one appears to be. Because, of course, South Africa, we have our own special brand of COVID, which is not doing us in too good stead because it seems to avoid a lot of the vaccines. Anyway, point is, government started rolling them out. When it began, I think it was last week, rolling out the first vaccines, the president in a big press conference got vaccinated, and he immediately declared victory, saying everyone said there would be chaos. But look, everything's running smoothly and we are moving ahead and everything is going well. Well, on day one, that seems to have been the case, but it couldn't last. And now there are already stories going around in the media of doctors, because, of course, health workers are being targeted first for the vaccination. And health workers are complaining that they are not able to get them. Some doctors told Eyewitness News that they were turned away from getting their vaccinations, even though they had appointments there. There was apparently a bit of worry that health workers were going to storm a hospital at some point to try and see Herman has just sneezed, to try and get the vaccine for themselves because there's fears that it's going to run out. And so far, according to the website MediaHack, which is really good for looking at all the official stats about COVID and that sort of thing, the government has managed to give 15,388 vaccinations so far. Sara, you have some insight or at least you have some stories about perhaps what's going on. So what do you think about the vaccine and what's going on?
Well, perhaps a story. My husband, who's medical, had a discussion with a colleague who had stood in a queue over the weekend at Baragwanath for such a long time. Nothing happened, and eventually he went home unvaccinated. And by all accounts, the two centres for vaccination of health workers in the province are Baragwanath and Steve Biko in Pretoria. Now, I don't know. That just strikes me as profoundly idiotic. I mean, if the government is dead set on having everything centralized and controlled from the center, but I would have thought the way to deal with this was for practices, hospitals, clinics, etc., to order the number of vaccines they would need to to be vaccinated and get them one, some way or another, and just do it themselves. I mean, this idea of going to to large hospitals on one end of the north or the south, I just don't get it. I just really, really don't get it. I mean, I see one person who stood in a queue, reported in the newspaper, had made an appointment, and she said that they were attending to people who didn't have appointments. I mean, you know, it's like the government doing what the government does best.
Yeah, no, exactly. So we can already see, just as with the personal protective equipment stuff, there was an enormous amount of corruption. I suspect that, unfortunately, the vaccine rollouts will have similar problems. And, of course, it's important to note that this isn't something you can just kind of take forever to do. Never mind the fact that, realistically speaking, you know, we're probably not going to have lockdown ended until a large portion of the population is vaccinated. But if you don't roll it out fast enough, the virus is going to mutate probably to get around the vaccine, right? If you don't kind of really push down the transmission numbers, and hopefully they're pretty low at the moment, that's what the data seems to be showing us. But if they spike back up again, there's a chance that the thing might mutate again, because every time it transfers from one person to another, there's another chance for it to mutate. And so if you do this thing really slowly, you're going to probably just breed another super variant of COVID. And there are, you know, there's a lot being said about people who don't want to take the vaccine. But honestly, at least half the country, I think, at least, is sort of eager to take this thing. And so you're not going to have any shortage of volunteers in the short term.
Yeah. I mean, if they're having this much trouble with say, using Gauteng as an example, if they're having this much trouble with frontline workers, with medical people, what is going to happen when they have to spread it out to a much larger group of people? And that's why I think, you know, we were all in favor of the private sector essentially doing its own thing from the get-go. And this just confirms it.
Yeah, no, exactly. The centralization is just going to cause problems all up and down the line, I think. You know, I also, this thing about only two sites now, I get they're focusing on medical personnel for now, which, and it's arguable whether that's a good idea or not. But, you know, they're focusing on these on a relatively small group to start off with, but that still doesn't seem like, you know, a lot of sites. I mean, Gauteng's a pretty big place. Having one in the south of Joburg and one in Pretoria is Not that great an idea.
It's ludicrous. That's why I suggest a whole different process should have been considered. But that's what happens when the government controls everything. It goes wrong most of the time.
Right.
And I think
Herman, your thoughts on the story.
Yeah, so I think on this point of if the government controls it, it goes wrong. This is something that I can't remember who that chap was that came to talk to us a few weeks ago about data and knowledge and, you know, concluding correctness or incorrectness or whatever. But the something that has really been mulling in my mind for the last week or two has been this idea, and I discuss it with you, Sarah, on IFM, that the reason we are in favor of the free market is not because we think the free market is magic or brilliant or just faultless. It is it compartmentalizes failure to a way that is quite useful if lives are on the line. It's a bit like the Titanic, where you had the separate compartments, and then, you know, if one of the compartments failed, then the ship would stay afloat, and two and three, but the problem with the South African government's approach is that it's one compartment. There's no fail-safe, there's no safety, there's no redundancy. If the government is, if there's a siren going off, I do really apologize. I don't know if you can hear it, but if the government is in control of something and it goes wrong for everyone. The market isn't brilliant in a sense that it is smarter. It just has more opportunities to fail with limited consequences. Mm-hmm. So to my mind, there are three reasons why the private sector should have been involved in this. Firstly, this very thing is to limit the effect of failure. That's why I'm also a fan of federalism. It's kind of this decoupling rather than one parallel system. Secondly, if the government is responsible for spreading these things and making these things available, that means taxpayers' money is being used to do that. Now, poor people who buy whatever, a can of beans, or I'm not sure if that's VAT exempt, but if a poor South African buys something and pays VAT on it, that goes into the tax pot. That tax pot is now being used to pay for my, is now being used to pay for my vaccine. So the poorest taxpayer in the country is subsidizing my vaccination that I could really have afforded without having to have the poorest taxpayer pay for it. That's the second thing. And then the third thing is just practically the speed of it. It's just so, so painful to have in the most populous province in the country to have two centers, and these two centers aren't even functioning operationally. It's just, yeah, we get your ideologues, but surely, surely, you could think that, you know, there's a political win here by just getting the vaccines out to people. So that's the thing. When we say get the private sector involved, it's not because we have shares in private sector companies that might, you know, laugh, or we think that this is a wonderful thing. It's just a more efficient way to fail. Failure being an inevitable part of any human process.
Right. I also think that, you know, like I said, there's a lot of people worried about vaccine skepticism. I think it's really not a big issue. And some people are, you know, hesitant to get one of the strands of vaccine, whereas they'd be okay with getting another one. And if the private sector was more involved and the government had, you know, done a better job of setting up our procurement processes to get these things, people would probably have a choice of which one they want to get, which would be nice.
But no, I mean,
instead, it's all sort of forced through one channel.
And that demotivates people to trust the whole thing. Because you know what's bizarre is if I go to my medicine cupboard now, I will probably have things by Pfizer and AstraZeneca there. In my medicine company. These are massive companies that provide many, many, many forms of medication that I take on a daily basis or on a regular basis. So there's no reason to distrust. But when you insert the government into it, in a country like South Africa, where the governance is so mistrusted, you are unnecessarily injecting mistrust into a system that actually should be quite trustworthy.
Right. And the Zuma camp seems to be kicking around a story, and I really don't know if it's true. But in fact, I have reason to suspect that it's not true, but it's still worth thinking about. And that this story is that the reason we're going with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is because Ramaphosa has connections through the CR17 campaign to a company that's distributing it or making it. And of course, this just causes more distrust and dysfunction in the whole system when you have a story like that going around.
Anyway.
Yeah,
and to be fair, I'm getting my weekly jibe in against corporate South Africa. It'll be difficult to find a corporate entity in South Africa not connected to the CRC.
Yeah, that's
just
a good
putting
point.
It out.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on. And another thing that I'm sure people are sick about hearing in the news, apart from COVID, is of course our ex-president Jacob Zuma, who the mainstream media is very keen on talking about. They're not so keen on him anymore, although they used to be. and he appeared at a ANC conference on Sunday night called the Umrabulo Roundtable Discussion. And they were talking about the themes of social cohesion and national question. Now, that was the title of the thing. I'm a little bit confused as to why the ANC thinks it's a great idea to have Zuma speaking now, considering that, you know, he's seems that it's possible he's in contempt of court and all these legal troubles floating around him. Apparently, that didn't seem to put them off too much, having him at the discussion. And he said some things at the discussion first. He made a point, a very sort of populist-y point, that the law is too soft on criminals. And that, you know, during apartheid, the law was too harsh, but now we've gone too far in the other direction, and now it's too soft on people. So that's him banging the populist drum, and, you know, there may or may not be some merits in some of those things. But he then went on to say, and this was far more disturbing, that Parliament contributes to a lack of social cohesion and nation building in the country, and that there is people just insult each other in the halls of Parliament, and there isn't enough constructive discussion. Now, well, I don't know about you, Herman, but this makes me think that there's a big push against things that are not the presidency right now. It's a very authoritarian kind of take.
Yes. I must say that there are a few things that to pick up here from almost theoretical perspective. Firstly, if you in 1 week manage to attack both the judiciary and parliament, then you're on maneuvers. I mean, that's not accidentally. So be very, very attuned to what's going on here, and be very attuned to the fact that the ANC is letting it happen. Minister Ramola has come to the defense of the judiciary to a certain extent, but I can't be the only one to have found that rather muted and rather delayed in time here, because whether it's Jacob Zuma, whether it's Cyril Ramaphosa, whether it's Esma Gashule, remember that there's an incentive here for the party that wants to centralize control to weaken mechanisms of decentralization, and the courts being one of that. You have the very famous Trias Politica, where you have the state divided into the executive, the legislature, and the court. So be very attuned to the fact that the ANC is essentially allowing criticism of the two non-executive branches of the state, parliament representing the voice of the people, and the judiciary representing the check on executive and parliamentary power. But then another question that I have with regard to this question of the law is too soft. What exactly does he mean? Does he mean the criminal procedure legislation isn't firm enough? Does he think that the prescribed sentencing structure is too loose?
He's drawing from his own experience of avoiding court dates for a very long period of time.
Yes. So I must say he's quite an expert at the law giving soft hugs. But there's a question here. When people say, the law has failed this country, you must understand that there are a few elements here. There's the actual legislation about what's right and wrong, where you demarcate criminal activity or not. Then you've got also the common law that has, by tradition, certain elements of behavior, societal behavior being illegal, murder, rape, those things being part of that. There's no law, strictly speaking, that says murder is illegal. It's, part of the common law inheritance. But then you also have the actual interpretation of the law through the judiciary. Then you have the investigative element of the law through the police. Then you have the correctional element of the law in terms of the jails and the rehabilitative role to play there. So when someone says the law in this country is too soft, it is a very vague statement. Does he mean legislation isn't tight enough? Or does he mean the common law hasn't been interpreted strictly enough by the courts? Or does he mean the police don't investigate hard enough? Or does he mean the National Prosecuting Authority doesn't prosecute aggressively enough? Or does he mean the courts don't actually find as significantly unfavorable findings for the accused? Or does he mean the correctional services are soft on prisoners? These are very interesting questions, because if it's going to be anything other than the common law or the legislative criminalization element, then he was probably firsthand responsible for hollowing out the institutions that he now accuses of being too soft. So this man is, politically, he's just genius. Just, throw out seven possible things. You're responsible for four of them. Three of them are nice and populist-y. So, yeah, you're a man of the people, certainly.
Yeah, there's another aspect to this, and that's connected to the fact that he's saying something. I mean, I think it's probably uncontroversial that a very large chunk of South Africans, if not a majority, do probably agree with the president that the law is too soft on criminals. And whether that's true or not, it is a popular thing to say. So the fact that he's saying popular things, that he's attacking the judiciary, that he's attacking parliament, he's undermining all these kind of pillars of democracy right at a time that the ANC, according to polling that we've done and stuff, is not looking so hot electorally. Sara, do you think that there is at least scheming by part of the ANC to go for a bit of an authoritarian push? Maybe they're not so keen on an election.
I actually think one shouldn't overanalyze it. I think it's Zuma in support of the RET faction, which is sort of cast itself as the more aggressive of the two factions, insofar as they are factions. It's like he's a psychopath. He's compartmentalizing. On the one hand, there's everything that he's done wrong that puts him in the criminal in chief category. And on the other hand, there's the thing that people want to hear about. I don't think he means any. I don't think he cares. I mean, this week he's going back to court for the arms deal corruption charges of, oh God, I was a lot younger when they started. He's got the contempt of court facing him on the Zondo Commission. I mean, he is a if it weren't Jacob Zuma, I'd say he's a complete hypocrite. I think he just says things to try and, you know, sort of wangle a little authority behind the people who support him. I don't think he means anything. Social cohesion is always a term I thought was, and I mean this in the philosophical sense, bullshit. It's, you know, none of this, parliaments are not there to enhance social cohesion. I mean, never. Right. People will cohese their own sociality.
Let me read the direct quote from him, because to me it does kind of raise the hairs on the back of my neck. He said, "Parliament as a very open and public institution is not helping to this debate that we are talking about. It's not in a sense contributing to the nation building." Really seems like he's saying Parliament is too. Discussing too many things.
but you know, the problem with that is that, I mean, the person who was shouted at more than anyone in the history of Parliament was Zuma himself. He was attacked by the EFF every single time the two parties appeared in Parliament. So he was the butt of it. But, wow, he didn't say anything then. He hasn't said anything shortly after that or a couple of years later. He's saying it now. I mean, now when we don't have much happening in Parliament from a physical point of view because most of it's online anyway. So I just think, you know, I think he has the ability to sort of imbue himself with an aura, and then he comes out and speaks and he sounds like a sort of elder statesman of the ANC when he's actually just an elder criminal waiting for conviction.
So, well, an elder statesman of the ANC.
Final question to you, Herman, is do you buy, do you think this is just him flailing about to grab onto whatever he can, or do you think that there's some more nefarious plots at work here?
Well, I think both, actually. I think he is a mischievous guy, knowing that the mischief he makes now diminishes his chance of you know, being held accountable for his corruption and so on. So I think, you know, just stirring the pot for the sake of stirring is in this case very helpful to him, and he's making life very difficult for his political and factional opponents within the ANC. So there's in one sense it's just, you know, just throwing excrement at the wall to see what sticks. As politicians the world over do very, very well. It's one of their skills. So that's the one thing. I think there is an element of just spontaneous mischievous here, mischievousness. But then on the other hand, I mean, he met with Julius Malema. You know,
Becky Taylor as well now.
And Becky Taylor. There is this fallback on a common strategic framework to what should happen to South Africa. That's always the thing that's quite difficult to grasp about the National Democratic Revolution and all that. It's not a conspiracy that is decided in the dark rooms with, you know, Cuban cigar smoke hanging everywhere, and they have a meeting every Wednesday night. It's far more fundamental than that. It's that you've programmed a whole generation or multiple generations of politicians to look at problems a certain way and look at solutions another way. So there is tactic and strategy in this, but I don't think it might be conscious. I think it is so part of his worldview that what is wrong with this country is the decentralization of power and stuff like that, that the spontaneous mischief and the overarching strategic objective of the National Democratic Revolution are so closely entwined that even his instinctive, unguided actions serve the movement.
Right. Anyway, I think we need to move on. But this question, we're hoping to have Franz Cronje back on our Wednesday show. And we'll be talking about what it takes to set up a new party and where a new party in South African politics might come from. But I also will try and get in a question to Franz there about this question about the ANC's move towards authoritarianism and see what he has to say about that. Anyway, let's move on now to complete the trifecta of things that South Africans are really bored about hearing about, and this is, of course, Eskom. So Eskom is looking to increase its prices. It's seeing a 15.6% tariff hike. It's being implemented on the 1st of April this year. But they want to see a further increase over the next couple of years. They want to jack the price up quite significantly because they say that even with this 15% increase, we're not even close to filling the costs of power generation in this country. Now, before we completely come down on this idea, obviously, you know, there's a lot of negatives to increasing the power, cost of power. But Eskom is in an enormous financial hole, as we know. I haven't been keeping up to date with the latest of the debt, but the last time I checked a couple of months ago, you know, it was at 450 billion rand in debt. That's like a third of an entire year's government budget underwater. So Eskom really does need to do something to change its trajectory in terms of finances. Sara, let me go to you first. Is price increases a good idea, or should they try something else?
Well, I don't think they have anything else to try. It's not a good idea for the consumer, particularly given the unreliability of Eskom and the fact that it actually has less generating power than it's ever had. How about trying to get as much stuff away from Eskom as is humanly possible and get the private sector involved? Now, I know I'm probably being a bit simplistic about it, but that is kind of what vaguely competent governments do when things are not working at the central level with the one gigantic monopoly, is you get it out. I mean, I gather that, you know, one of Eskom's concern, other than the fact that its generation is unreliable, is also the fact that, you know, within a couple of years, you're getting a carbon tax coming on stream. You're getting a push for policies on all sorts of renewable energies increasing and coming into the marketplace. You know, I don't know, but I just see us paying more, a lot more, really a lot more, to probably not even get it to the point of zero. And we're just kicking the can down the road.
So Herman, one of the criticisms that's given of the sort of private sector argument is at the moment in South Africa, most of the private electricity producers, I believe, are renewable energy. And the argument goes that energy is much more expensive. And so if you buy from the private sector, it's going to actually push up the costs because some of the electricity is now going to be coming from wind and solar, which is quite expensive. Your thoughts on this question in general and that point specifically, Herman?
Well, if people want to pay more for reliable stuff, let them pay more. I mean, this is why you have cars like Lexus and Mercedes and BMW and Audi, and all of them aren't Tatas and, you know, Chanas, because you pay a premium for reliability and for quality. And I think if people want to pay more for more reliable stuff, then they should. I mean, that's why we all have private security. We already pay taxes for the police to do what private security entities do now, but because we actually want private security, we decided, well, we as middle-class South Africa will fork out more.
To get to that state, though, we'd have to have a free market in electricity, which we're very far away from.
Absolutely. And on that score, a few things that I've been following the Eskom situation. The first thing is that this tariff hike, if I understand correctly, will bring in 10 billion rand. Now, that sounds a lot unless you realize that Eskom's debt is more than 460 billion. So, you know, it's a 46th of their debt. So, firstly, it takes skill to take a monopoly and make a loss of it. I mean, that's it. You must be really committed to failure to take a monopoly and make a loss of it. And then secondly, we have this PR push. What can we expect from Eskom? Well, a PR push that I think we've seen over the last few weeks. For example, André de Reiter spoke to the Free Market Foundation, who I have immense respect for, and I appreciate a lot of what they do. But you would see that in a weird way, I'm fearing that he has now neutralized a very strong critic of this state-dominated approach. And if you actually go look at what was the headline announcement from that engagement, 2,000 jobs to be cut. Well, that's a voluntary severance package. And if you listen to people, you speak to people on the inside of Eskom, you get the idea that it was people who competent people who desperately wanted to get out of Eskom. At the moment those 2000 severance packages became available, they just ran for it, very what happened to the teachers in the Mandela era.
Absolutely.
So you're losing skill, and this is all just PR bluff.
Right. And our colleague Gabriel made this point last week, actually, is that until you actually cut costs, and by cutting costs, I mean, you know, firing the people who are not performing, who are at the bottom of the rung rather than the ones who can get a job somewhere else and taking voluntary things. The moment until you get rid of BEE procurement practices, which push up the price because it reduces the size of the market where you can buy from, until you tackle those things, Eskom is never going to make a profit. You can jack the price up higher and higher, and all that's going to happen is people are going to go off the grid.
Yeah.
It's this death spiral. Higher prices, more alternatives. Fewer people using the goods, so prices higher need prices. To go up.
Exactly. And so if they don't cut costs, they're really flailing in the wind here, and we're just going to hurt the economy by those who can't get alternative power will just have to pay more, and those who can will go off the grid.
And I know we're pushed for time here, but just one thing that I want people to realize, that we got load shedding amidst lockdown.
There was no economy.
There was no economy. So we can't have outsized demand. How can you have too much demand when you shut down the massive swathes of your economy?
And until Durator takes on those political problems as CEO and forces the government to fire him for tackling their sacred cows, he's not going to fix a damn thing.
It's going
to be like others.
A very, very interesting point is, let's keep an eye on whether a Durator comes under political pressure. If he doesn't, there's a very good reason for that. That's because he's doing what the politicians would have wanted him to do in the first place.
Right.
There's no reason for there to be pressure, so there's no pressure. Let's keep an eye on that.
Right. Anyway, we will have to close now. So thank you very much for listening. Please share this video, like this video, share this podcast, like this podcast, review this podcast, all those good things. Please support the IRR.org.za. Check out our campaigns. Sign our submission against the expropriation without compensation bill. And we'll see you tomorrow for another edition of the Daily Friend Show. Have a great week, everyone.